I just can't. I don't know. I don't care. Those stuff at the beginning, I'd rather hang with them and not. So. I think people are like, oh, it's fine. You know, it's not hard enough. Yeah, there's some back there in the night. If you go, you know, I kind of put these back here for staff if you guys want to sit back. So we just started sending things. So I send them stuff.
So they saw that on there.
What is it?
Oh, there's just this update.
Yeah, he told me about it. I have like 2 seconds.
We just mentioned it. I think we're good because Mark will be here, so if I have to come to this.
Yeah, like I said,
all I have to do is do blank and hit play, right?
Yep.
I just have to set it down here.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
And welcome everyone. We'll call the meeting to order. And we'll start with, we're great to see everyone here. And we'll start with welcomes and introductions. I'm Jim Swain, representing the judiciary. And we'll start with my right.
I'm Pat Fuller, Department of Licensing.
I'm John Esp, Department of Transportation, here on behalf of Secretary Hughes.
I'm Sandy Mullins, the Governor's Office.
Darren Grandel, Director here at the Traffic Safety Commission.
Jerry Nelson, Traffic Safety Commission.
Curtis Tell, the State Patrol, and I represent the Chief of Police.
Alan Jones, Director of Student Transportation, representing the Mayor of Superintendent of Construction.
John Snyder, Spokane City Council, and AWC Rep.
And we'll have introductions of staff as well as members of the public. And just to let you know, you can say your name as loudly as you would like to make sure your name gets picked up. Otherwise, on the minutes, you'll be down as inaudible.
Hi, I'm Joanna Van Dyke, and I'm with the Traffic Safety Commission.
I'm Marsha Masters, the Traffic Zero Manager. It's at County.
Bruce Jung, Department of Licensing.
I'm Jane Codd, Traffic Safety Commission. Who is the Metal Department of Licensing?
Dusty Green, Lewis County.
Steve Oss, Detective Sergeant, Lewis County Sheriff's Office, and Lewis County LEO.
John Pagel, Traffic Zero Manager for Southland County.
Marty Miller, Washington State Patrol.
David Wright, the Target Zero Manager for Walking Down.
Jerry Novello, Target Zero Manager for First Time.
Melody Nelson, Target Zero Manager for Lewis County.
April Kelly, Social Services Manager for Lewis County.
Tom Martin, State Patrol at the Operations Patrol.
Mark McGowan with the Washington Traffic Safety Commission.
Etika Skella, Program Manager with the Traffic Safety Commission.
Yeah, thank you, everyone, and welcome. We do not have a quorum to approve the minutes, so we'll set that over until our April 16th meeting. I'm going to turn some time over to Deputy Chief Patel regarding Trooper Gaucher. Some of you may have heard already well that Trooper Gaucher, Chief Gaucher, provide the details, and then perhaps after his summary, we have more insight.
Thank you, sir. We've got a trooper that's trying to get out on that. He originally came from Tacoma a few years ago, but he died very early in the morning of pneumonia, which is something that we just don't hear about much in this day and age, especially when it's especially hard time for us because this wasn't something that was a drawn out type of illness. This guy had been working Friday. Felt a little bit sick, got a little bit sicker on Saturday, got really sick on Sunday, was in the hospital, went into cardiac arrest several times, and just never recovered. It's one of those things where he's a big guy, a strong guy, apparently had had pneumonia for some time, and it just got septic in the system, and by the time he finally decided it was time to seek treatment, it was pretty much too late. 13-year Marine Corps veteran, 17-year WSP veteran, 48 years old. So his whole adult life was serving this nation and serving the state. I met a couple times, it didn't go real well, but he was one of those guys that just was a pity of the state trooper. It's quite a loss for us. The service is going to be this Saturday over the aftermath.
Thank you, Chief. Perhaps everyone on the side.
Our thoughts and prayers go out to troops who share it. Co-workers. Thank you. Commissioner Kohler, motion.
So I'll go ahead and tee up the video, but just wanted to share a video that we worked on through a grant with the Traffic Safety Commission. As you all are probably familiar, motorcycle fatality is a level 2 priority in Target Zero. And this video is really taking off and was intended to be generic so that others could pick it up. There's some really interesting statistics. The video actually launched December 1st, and it is about a rider that teaches a young driver about safely sharing the road with motorcycles. And so it launched December 1st. On our website, it already has had 252,000 hits with over 50 countries to include U.S., Poland, Canada, Finland, and the United Kingdom. I think of interest, too, is that in China, they actually have redid the video in the Chinese language. So it really is taking off. And very popular. One of the persons involved in the motorcycle riding arena nationally took the video and put it on their website, and that website has 4.7 million hits. So the video has gained a lot of popularity. It's really good, and people are really the message. People are really. Across with the message that we have. Julie, do you want to add anything?
The only thing I would add is there are lots of motorcycle safety videos out there. What makes this one a little bit more unique is most of the videos that currently exist are geared towards the rider and how to ride safer, whether it's with your equipment, watch out for cars, going around curves, things like that. This one is geared more at the young driver, which it's a very different approach in how to share the road safely with motorcycles. Because as you all know, they're the most experienced riders out there, so there's things that they're just not aware of.
So, we can add the video.
Yeah, so let's make
with you? Are you stupid?
Didn't see you. I'm so sorry.
You pulled right out in front of me. What, you didn't see that big bike with the bright headlights shining right at you?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, a lot of good that does me now. Leave! I gotta show you some things, kid. And you need to listen. Listen good. Don't forget anything that I'm gonna say.
No, I won't forget.
I don't think we got much time. Get in. Trust me, kid. Just hit the gas and keep going left. Pull over in that spot. See those cars and trucks coming towards us down the road, kid? How fast are they going?
I don't know, maybe 35, 40 miles an hour?
Yeah, that's about right. Keep looking at the road, kid. Now, see that motorcycle way in the distance? How fast is that going?
I have no idea.
Keep looking.
I have no idea, it's hard to tell.
Exactly, kid, exactly. That bike is much smaller than a car. You hear me, buddy? Much smaller. Makes it tough to judge its speed and distance. You see where I'm going? Whenever you see that single headlight or two headlights close together, you have got to give it some extra space. Simple rule, kid. Look twice before you ever pull out, before you ever do anything around a bike. You have got to look twice.
Look twice. Got it.
All right. Back out on the road, kid. Follow that bike. Give him a little breathing space. You see that taillight? How big is it?
Looks pretty small.
Exactly. And you know what else? Because those taillights are always on,
it's a heck of a lot harder to notice when they put on their brakes. Especially in the daytime.
See what he did there? Moved his bike over so he can be seen by the car ahead of him. It's easy enough for a car to get lost in a blind spot, even easier for a motorcycle. That's why you have to be sure there's nobody there before you ever change lanes. Something tells me we don't have a lot of time left, kid. Ah, you're doing good. Might be hope for you yet. Take a left up to the next light. Big Bear! Wild Bill!
Hey, buddy. Nice ride, man. Why aren't you on your bike?
Big Bear!
Wild Bill!
Dog! Teaching the kid how to drive around bikes.
See you later.
Look at that. Bikes accelerate so much faster than cars, and they brake faster than most cars, too, so don't ever get too close. We gotta get back. Motorcycles are vulnerable around any kind of car, kid. A little dent for you could be something horrible for us. Doesn't matter who's at fault, the rider always gets the worst of it.
I got it.
Serious injury or even death.
I got it. Seriously. I got it, Big Bear.
Call me Randy, kid.
Randy? Big Bear fits you better. Your name's Randy, huh?
Since the day I was born. Since the day I was born. You got a name, kid?
Ian. It's Ian.
Ian. You're all right, Ian. Makes this all the harder.
Don't go back to your bike, Big Bear.
Got to. You need to get in your car. Now.
Just stay. We can change what's...
Don't work that way, kid.
Ian, remember.
Look twice. I got it.
Mistakes. But mistakes like Ian made happen way too often. Even a simple mistake that causes a dent to a car can kill a rider. We need your help making our road safer for motorcyclists.
I'm a mom and I'm a rider. I train on the racetrack to improve my skills so I can be safer on the street and get home to my family. Thanks for watching this video and thanks for watching out for me and doing your part to help me get home safely.
Hey guys. Whether two wheels or four, training is everything. It gives us the skills to be safer out on the street. You know, inside your car is somebody's son or daughter. Under our helmets is somebody's brother, sister, friend, or...
Daddy!
We all have a lot of choices to make out there on the road. So train hard, drive well, and please, for Randy and Ian's sake, for your sake, and for ours. Make your choices, good ones. Thanks.
So there's an extra copy of the video if anyone's interested in it. But thanks for letting us share that. Thanks to State Control for helping us with it as well.
And I will ask that this has now been distributed to all the training schools in the state, and this is going to be part of.
So if we wanted to link to it on our website, that's something that we could.
Yep. It's on our website on YouTube.
In fact, the more you push it, the more.
It's amazing. I gotta be honest, I was a little skeptical when you said how many little white hits. I thought, how can motorcycle safety? Now I'm amazed. That's a pretty well.
We've had lots of requests from other states asking to incorporate it in their programs, to put it on their website. There's a couple federal agencies that have it on their website as well. And then, like you said, we do the analytics for showing it's just going crazy in other countries. And I actually printed out the one from China where they translated.
Yeah, here it is right
here. Wow.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. We did not expect it to take off the way it has. We knew it would be popular within the riding community, but had no idea to the extent that it was.
The tweet on it says, "Your motorcycle awareness video has reached China and is being shared by my biking buddies." Pretty positive. And just a short period of time, too. That's a lot of hits in a month.
I just want to say it's great, too. I've never seen anything quite that perspective. This hope you can pull an advertising button between all your YouTube hits.
So on the grant application, did it just say motorcycle safety video? Mm-hmm. Okay. See, you know, you wonder when you look at the grant proposals, you know, is it a motorcycle?
Yeah, it's really well done.
The teenager in that video, actor from up in the Gig Harbor area, and he was very excited after he got hired. He was like, "You mean all my friends in drive training school are going to see me?"
And then the last person is one of the one of our staff in the motorcycle program. So yeah,
he did pretty good.
Yeah, he did pretty good.
Huh? So you're now becoming international rock stars.
Yeah,
I can say we've got worldwide.
So. Yes. And that's amazing, you know, to see what, you know, came out as a vision, as an idea, is now making an international impact. So great work with, a lot of teamwork involved in this as well. Did you want to show? Yeah. Maybe you want to give a little, do you want to give a little lead in on this, the toy run?
The toy run?
Yeah, either you or Mark?
Mark, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Washington Traffic Safety Commission, along with Department of Licensing, we had an opportunity to have a vendor booth this year at the Olympia Motorcycle Toy Run. It is the largest motorcycle toy run in the state. So we purchased a booth, and we didn't know what kind of reaction we would get, but it was all positive. And then we had one of our contractors go down, and they brought a small camera crew, and they just kind of documented the day. We're getting positive feedback from that as well. A lot of people that are involved with the Toy Run Coalition are taking it and wanting to share the video as well and stuff, because they just say, you know, they were skeptical about having the government come in, and they were asking, you know, is it going to be law enforcement? Who's going to be there? What is your reason behind being there and stuff? And we explained it was all about promoting our motorcycle safety campaign. And when we came in, now they're already asking us to come back next year. One of the pieces that you'll see in this video is a truck and trailer wrap that we partnered with Interstate Distribution out of Tacoma. And they have three trailers wrapped in a motorcycle safety message. And so we parked it along the parade route as kind of a billboard. So,
and they handed out lots of information about the importance of training. And what was nice is afterwards, one of the local bike clubs volunteered to help clean up the parking lot where everybody meets. And they called later just to say, hey, there was lots of garbage here, and none of it was the stuff you guys were handing out. So people were hanging on to it rather than tossing it. So that was nice.
That's a performance measure.
So big thanks to the licensing staff. I mean, we had the booth and asked them to come down, but you guys are the ones with the experts and the trainers, and it was great to have you guys down there to be able to answer the questions from the training side of things. And you know, we're more of the safety side of things, but most of the questions most of the riders were asking about the training opportunities in the state.
You were great, though. You stood in the ring with
them. Yeah, you'll see how wet and cold it was when you see some of the people out here.
I'm Mark McDowell, and I'm with the Washington State Traffic Safety Commission. We're the State Highway Safety Office for Washington. This is a huge event. I believe this is the largest motorcycle toy run in the state. It's Christmas time. It's making sure that we can raise money and raise toys for the people in our community that need it.
We donate all these toys to the Salvation Army, and they have a program that's set up through their Toy Joy Shop. Families will, later this month, will be able to come down and pick out the toys. Since we started back in 1976, we've donated over $2 million worth of cash and toys. It's all about the kids. And that's why we do this.
We're here, just like all the other bikers, we're here to support the kids. It's the joy of giving back to kids. That's a bad thing when you can't wake up for Christmas and don't have anything. And I feel it's our job as a motorcycle community to give back. You know, that's the most important thing, to give back.
It's not about a particular type of motorcycle. It's not about a particular type of riding group or club. It's about coming together for the kids, and that's what it's about. And it shows. It shows that motorcycle riders are the first in line when it comes to giving back to their community.
For the past 25 or so years, we just can't resist helping the kids and bringing out the toys for all the kids that are less fortunate. And I think everybody has a great Christmas. We feel blessed to be able to perform for this crowd and be a part of this great event. We wouldn't miss it for the world.
For the Traffic Safety Commission to be a part of it made perfect sense to come down and just let people know about the message that we have for keeping people safe. Up to this date this year, we have seen about 64 motorcycle fatalities in the state. That is actually the lowest that we've seen in the last 10 or 12 years. But we also don't celebrate that. That's 64 people that died on their motorcycle this year. That's 64 families that have lost somebody. I mean, it's just countless people that are affected by each one of those fatalities. So our It's a Fine Line campaign and the efforts that we're making with our partner agency, we're out there trying to make sure that there's nobody that dies on their motorcycle next year. We're not going to celebrate that the numbers are going down, but progress is good.
This is Santa Joe. I'm wishing you guys all a very Merry Christmas from the Olympia Toy Run. And don't forget, it's all about the kids.
Merry Christmas from the Seattle Cossacks.
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas, everybody, and Happy New Year.
Next item, anything further about the video? I like that.
Well, it's just nice to be able to be involved in the community, being able to get the message, and working with the Washington Trucking Association and Interstate Distribution to be able to put those trailer wraps up was a big plus for us, to be able to get a lot of advertisement. You know, I mean, working with commercial vehicles, you know, they have a hard time sometimes seeing those bikes because they disappear next to the commercial vehicles. So being able to join those two communities in this project as well, you know, Mark's done a tremendous job working with Julie's group and with motorcycles with DOL. So, I mean, it's a team effort in this process. So great to see this kind of, at least a step forward on this new motorcycle campaign.
Next item on the agenda, suspended drivers from Internet Sensation Pat Kohler.
We have Julie Knittle and Bruce Chung here today to do a presentation on some of the great data that we've been able to collect on some legislation that passed in 2012 that changed how we treat the types of violations that result in suspended drivers. So some of the non-moving violations have, through legislation, been in the past have been treated as a way to suspend drivers, and that wasn't the best use of state patrol's times. We wanted to make sure that when we suspend drivers, it's for reasons that help reduce fatalities and serious injuries on the road. So in 2012, that legislation passed. And we've been collecting data since that time. The other thing that's happening, though, is AMBA, which is the American Motor Vehicle Association, has created best practices, and this legislation and reducing the number of non-moving violations that can be treated for suspension is a best practice. And so they, from a national level, were very interested in what kind of data Washington was able to show based on the change in legislation in 2012. I think the data is very impressive, and so Julie and Bruce are going to give you some background on this that we've been able to accomplish since that change.
Okay. So I'm going to start by giving a little bit of history. So suspending driving privileges has been used for decades to address poor driving behavior. And the reason for that is research has shown that it's effective in reducing crashes. Originally, there were three goals to suspending drivers, and that was to remove the dangerous drivers from the road, change driving behavior, or punish unsafe drivers. But what happened over time is a fourth goal emerged, and it just sort of happened. It wasn't intentional. And that was to gain compliance for social nonconformance violations, which you'll hear that term, and really it's pretty synonymous with non-highway safety related. So, for example, bounce checks, truancy, not paying library fines, not renewing your dog fine, those are actually reasons people get suspended in other states. Vandalism. So those are examples of these non-highway safety related or social non-conformance type violations. And the result of that is when states are suspending for those types of violations, it creates a watered down effect for the driver, for everybody involved in the process, and including law enforcement, courts, things like that. So in 2002, across the country, 29% of all suspended drivers fell into that category, the social nonconformance or non-highway safety related. By 2006, that had grown to 39%. That's a huge number. And these, again, are non-highway safety related violations. These are not your bad drivers that pose a risk. There's a significant cost to arresting, processing, testifying in court, administering the suspension, that whole process, it's very significant on resources and budgets for all agencies and organizations involved. And ultimately what that does is it detracts from the highway and public safety priorities that we want to focus on. So along comes AMVA, the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, and for those of you that don't know who and what AMVA is, They're a nonprofit organization, and what they do is they develop model programs for DMVs, law enforcement, and highway safety organizations across the country, including Mexico and Canada. So they play an important role for our state. And as a result, they provide guidelines, policies, they develop best practices, and what they try and do is then get that out across all these jurisdictions to create uniformity so we're all doing things in a like manner. So AMBA put together a working group, and they recognized that this was a problem, that this is continually growing and detracting from the priorities that jurisdictions want to focus on. So they created the working group with an objective to reduce the number of suspended drivers on the road by addressing that group that are non-highway safety related, identify what those violations are, so look at the whole range of options and then slice and dice and decide what is highway safety, what is not, and then find other ways to address the non-highway safety group and then limit the suspensions to those who really do pose a risk to the public. So there was a study conducted with 8 states across the country. We were not one of the states. And out of that study, Bruce is going to go into more detail on what that study talked about, so I won't spend too much time on that. But out of the study came the recommendation that states repeal the laws for things like bad checks, truancy, vandalism that would result in a suspension. They would like them handled in another manner. Thereby unclogging the system by 39% of these drivers. We participated in the work group. It was about a year and a half. I participated on that work group. And as I was sitting there, and we're talking about the study, and this group consisted of public and private sector. There were federal representatives. There was law enforcement. There were courts, judges. It was a wide variety of people on this group from all across the country. And as I was sitting there and we're talking, I remembered there were some things going on in Washington that I felt might be something that we want to look into. So as I'm sitting there, Bruce and a couple others in our agency were getting emails on a minute-by-minute basis of what do we look like here, what do we look like here, what do we got going on. And so it resulted in a much deeper dive into what does Washington have going, how do we compare to the study, and then ultimately what are our results. So Bruce has done all that work, and he's going to take you through, talk about the study that was conducted, how Washington compares, and then where we go from here.
Okay. One in the middle, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Go ahead. You brought this down the whip line. Julie covered a little bit about the background. I'm going to talk a pinch more and what it means, especially to the agencies that have to deal with these suspensions. And a lot of focus is going to be on law enforcement and what it means to them. Failure to pay a ticket resulted in a suspension. Now, this went in the past for any ticket. You get a ticket for not having a blinker working, or speeding, or hit and run, or you name it, it didn't matter. I'm not wearing a seatbelt. If you didn't pay that ticket, we were directed to suspend that driver. And this created a whole lot of suspensions going ultimately to court. We'll talk about how that gets there. When they're arrested for driving after they have been suspended, they get a driving license suspended citation, which involves a whole lot of business. And part of that's a court appearance, part of it's booking in jail, part of it's impoundment of the vehicle, and so on and so forth. What AMBA recommended was suspending only for those tickets that pose a threat, as Julie was talking about. They had a specific focus on the social nonconformance things. The big elephant in the room in our case is a lot of the child support non-payment. We suspend a lot of people for that. That's a federally mandated thing, so we don't have a lot to say in that matter. But there are some other things we'll touch on those as well. There were also a whole lot of things that were minor violations that they recommended not suspending for if the people failed to pay those tickets. And they wanted people to find other ways to do that. To try to encapsulate the difference between Washington's approach versus the AMBA recommended approach, they talked about what they called highway safety related and non-highway safety related, not suspending for the non-highway. And what Washington did was, through a lot of back and forth with the legislature, DOL and some other agencies were charged with defining what's going to be a moving and a non-moving violation, and taking the moving violations and continuing to suspend for those, but stopping suspending for the non-moving. The blinker doesn't work. You don't pay your ticket. If you get stopped again, you're not going to go to jail. You're probably going to get another ticket. Now, what AMBA did was take the 8 states in their study and codify them by the what they call the AMBA code dictionary, or the ACD codes. You hear that. Basically, they end up as highway safety, not highway safety. Washington's approach was using moving and non-moving, as well as we address the social nonconformance in our state, which is not nearly as severe as some other states, thank goodness. The vast majority of them line up in a similar manner. I've got a little visual here. Moving violations mostly equal the highway safety related, according to the ACD codes. Got your non-moving there, and your highway safety related. Now you see a little intersection in there. There are some things that Washington has that we have as non-moving violations that AMBA is saying you should probably not suspend for those things. So there's still some room to improve even further than what you'll see we've done already. The director had talked about our 2012 legislation that amounted to moving violations only. It's nearly identical, as we just saw in the last slide, nearly identical to the AMBA recommendation. Take the highway safety people, deal with them, don't suspend to the non-highway safety. We have only 5 that fall into that social non-conformance, and they're, for the most part, not a whole lot of violations there. There are a lot of non-payment of child support. There's a few minor possessions and fraud. The other two, I think, are zeros or onesies and twosies. There's none there.
There haven't been any on the books for the fuel theft and leaving a child in a running vehicle, and we believe it's because typically when those things happen, they're charged with more serious offenses and not here.
Yeah. So that those are kind of a moot point. So regarding the 8 states that they used in their study, about 2/3 of their violations were highway safety, and our split was similar. What you see here is on the left-hand side, the AMBA study, you got the 30-some-odd% of the non-highway safety where they said don't suspend these guys anymore. When we split ours into moving and non-moving, it's similar, a little bit more of the non-moving, and this is that overlap I was talking about. There's some of the non-moving that could move over into the highway safety bucket. The social non-conformance piece actually makes up a fairly small piece of the big pie here. What you'll see is, of all of that half, roughly, of the moving violations we are suspended for, of those suspensions, only about 18% are the social non-conformance people. And again, the majority of those we're kind of legally obligated to address, and some of them are on the federal level. Now, focusing on highway safety is important because they're the greatest threat. What we see here is the average person on the street that's not suspended, about 3 out of 100, will get into a collision in a given year. If you think about 100 of your friends, 3 of them probably haven't been there this year. May or may not have been their fault. put on the highway safety folks, almost 19% of those folks have had a collision. Now what that boils down to is they're six times more likely than the average person to have a collision, and this is why it's important to focus on these facts. The percent of people that are continuing to drive after they're suspended, in other words, they pick up a WP on the LS30, almost 7% of the highway safety folks continue to drive anyway. And we'll see what that means in terms of labor on many fronts here in a second. The other piece is the people who commit another violation. Fully a third of the folks that commit a highway safety violation will commit another violation after they've been suspended. So to recap the law change, we're going to go into the after effects here in a second, which is the fun part. You know, going to make any difference. We're targeting the most risky folks. Suspending only for those that are highway safety related. We've done that with this bill that started in June 2013, and we'll want to remember that date. We'll come up here in a slide in a second. And Washington's being looked at nationally as a leader in this regard because the efforts that have taken place in this state are nearly identical to what AMBA recommended to you. Now the impacts, about a year and a half have happened. And the first objective is to look how many failure to appear or failure to pay. These are the people that got the tickets and didn't pay. How many of those folks have we taken off the table? But the more important objective is how many of the people that got the driving with license suspended after the fact, how many of those went away? And I'll show you why that's important. The people that get caught driving anyway, they get arrested, their vehicle gets impounded, they go to jail, they're booked. That's not even addressing the bail part of it. And then they have a mandatory court appearance. So this impacts the courts. It impacts the Department of Licensing because they have paperwork involved. And it greatly impacts the law enforcement. The EMMA study found that it costs 9 hours of law enforcement time to process one of these guys by the time you stop them and do all these things in the court. Now, the first part of this is the failure to pay or failure to appear. What did we actually do? Well, we knocked 12,000 of these records off the table each month. What you see, the little red box is a dramatic drop immediately following the implementation of this law. That's 12,000 times somebody at the Department of Licensing doesn't have to enter things on a drive record. 12,000 individuals who are not being suspended each month. Now, this isn't to say they're off the hook. This goes to a collections agency, and then the collections agency goes after these people for their fines. So, one might think that they might even have greater success collectively that the courts are interested in getting. Now, the DWLS-3 violations, it's not retroactive. 6284 left on the table all the people that had been suspended prior to June 2013 that had been suspended for the non-highway safety or, in our case, non-moving violations. Until they pay their fines, they're still on the hook. So there's over 100,000 people out there that are still suspended for these things that are haunting them. But we didn't wipe the slate clean. We still got to clean that mess up. So, as they kind of wash out, we get fewer and fewer out there that are likely to be stopped and pick up a driving license suspended. But we're still beginning to see some decline. I did this in November. At that point, there was 531 fewer DWLS-3 tickets being issued each month. So you see this decline here. Over the period of time since this thing's been implemented. Now, kind of to recap that piece, we see 12,000 people not being suspended, and then we see about 500 BWLS3s not happening, And what does that equate to? And this is where the savings comes in. That 9 hours of time, trooper time, ladies, troopers, across the board, it goes for everybody. But 9 hours of law enforcement time to do all of these things to process a DWS 3 case. And we got 531 of those cases each month. And if we multiply that out by 12 months, by 9 hours, that's over 57,000 hours of law enforcement time not being spent on these nuisance cases that really don't make much difference in the big scheme of things. What that allows WSP and all the other law enforcement folks out there to do is concentrate on the truly safety-related, highway safety-related violations that are a threat. Now, if we look at other outcomes, you know, it's not just law enforcement that's impacted. DOL is not processing those 12,000 suspensions every month. For the first time in a very long time, there's no backlog in that unit. They're caught up. They have this mountain of work. You know, at 12,000 cases a month, even if it's only a couple of minutes, it's 24,000 minutes in a month. And this is a relatively small unit, so you have to process all this stuff. The courts are freed up from over 500 mandatory court appearances. I'm sure that makes the courts happy. I know that prior to, there was a lot of discussion about this before this law came about. And the Public Defenders Association was contacting me quite regularly about data and stats and wanted to know how many of this and how many of that, because their caseloads were just clogged up with these nuisance cases, these DWS-3s. They estimated as much as 60% of their caseloads were these things, where they had important cases to work on. The FTAs have been moving to the collection agencies, and that's probably poetic justice. For anybody that's been bothered by one of those people at 8 o'clock at night, I would rather probably have pins stuck in my eyes and have to deal with that on a regular basis. Any questions?
Before we have questions, I want to say that AMBA did put out their best practice document and a video, which is online at the AMBA website. Chief Batiste is interviewed in this video and talks about the importance of this. And then additionally, it's also, I was going back through the Target Zero Guide, and it's in there as a level 2 priority as well. So with that, are there any questions? I will also add one more thing, sorry. There has been two articles in the Washington Post regarding this issue being a problem nationally, and AMBA has directed the Washington Post to look at Washington State. That was in November. At the time, we weren't releasing this data publicly, so I anticipate now that it's going more public that we'll have follow-up on those stories, as well as NPR, who has done two stories, and AMBA said, go talk to Washington. And AMBA is pursuing money with NHTSA right now to try and replicate this in two other states and essentially copy what Washington has done and bring a team of folks in to help set that.
Okay. Do you have a calculation of jail days saved? This issue I've heard before is, I mean, it'd be nice to quantify something we've done at a state level that helped alleviate some of the costs at a local level, and I assume jail days would be probably pretty significant savings based on this.
We might be able to get into that through other agencies' assistance and guidance and inquiry. I don't know personally. Okay. I don't really have that, but perhaps there's some data that the Guidelines Commission might be able to.
Yeah, I'm thinking if we could talk, maybe there's a way to get to that.
Yeah, a peer that works with there that wants to be in favor of me and use it.
Will this report be memorialized in the document you sent?
So we have a one-page summary that has been memorialized, but I'm happy to, I can send it in for distribution along with the presentation.
Oh, yeah.
And I can just go ahead and include the link to the video and the website.
I have just a question. When you did the analysis and you show the percent of suspended drivers for safety-related factors that are involved in collisions, have we broken that out to how many of those are fatals and serious injury and that kind of thing? Okay.
I can see if I can slice that up.
I'd just be curious to show that piece of it, because I think, too, is if now we've taken a lot of these folks out of the system. I mean, I don't know if you're using this as a lean project, you know, to show all those cost savings and narrowing things down and that, but this, I mean, this is one of those critical things that has an impact on even the commercial driver folks, because they'd get stopped at 2 in the morning. It just says they were suspended. It doesn't list what they were suspended for. They're placed out of service. Come to find out, it was because they didn't pay a library fine or they're walking their dog in the park without a leash, and now they're suspended. The load's held up. So, I mean, this has huge economic impacts in a lot of different factors. So I'm glad to see that they've made some changes. And I remember when they first started talking about this, and I thought, oh, you'll never get states to move forward on some of this.
Yeah, and the patrol head captain, Barry, on the work group, pretty much given the happy dance when this was developing.
Mm-hmm.
Darren's right. I mean, just anecdotally, the amount of fatality collisions that we have, especially the alcohol-related stuff, is overrepresented by suspended drivers, and that would be a great thing to be able to push back and show that it's even more important. Because what we want to do is we want to maintain the teeth and suspension, because we have a lot of prosecutors that just don't want to fool with it because of what's happened. Suspension rules about that, driving this kind of almost everything longer than that.
There are some states that have as much as 41 non-highway safety related laws on the books. Wow. We were not in near as bad a shape as some other states.
Thank goodness. But our legislation is being looked at by other states too, as it does practice.
You know, is there any move to address that overlap between what AMCO recommends and what we have on the books as far as definitions for safety related?
So we have our leg and policy director has committed with the patrol to be willing to have those discussions. It's not obviously driven by solely us. But I think that there is a through spend, a little bit of wiggle room there that could definitely be looked at. And so he has that on his radar for this session. Should there be interest?
A little background. I started from perspective from the courts, judicial system. I started in the prosecutor's office in 1978. Back then, if you got a driving while suspended, you got 5 days in jail for your first one, unless you show up in court with a license, but usually you couldn't show up in court with a license. The theory being that you were a bad driver, you had a DUI hit and run or something like that, and the state told you not to drive and you went out to probate anyway, so you got 5 days. Over time, that kind of changed the way you didn't work through, and then they got reduced. And I know in 2000, essentially once the 2000 started, the first two or three driving while suspended to go to jail, at least not Clark County. And it was either June 3rd, 2004, or June 4th, 2003, the Redmond versus Moore decision came out having to do with getting notice on driving while suspended, third degree, and immediately our criminal traffic docket went down by 45%. Over time, it went up, and around 2000, to have a license restoration program. Now our prosecutors, two or three years ago, they started a diversion program for driving while suspended, reductions if you get your license back. But things got so bad that there were so many that our prosecutors actually, on your first four driving while suspended, you got a third degree, but it was not paying a fine. You got a reduced for a traffic infraction, $124 penalty, and you only got a conviction on the fifth one. And then you only had to do maybe one day of work versus 78 when I started, and we did 5 days in jail on that. But we have had a little bit of a reduction on what we're sitting in court. We have a driving while suspended docket, one for the city, one for the county. We have two commissioners on Thursday mornings. They start at 8:30 and finish about 12:30, doing nothing but driving while suspended reviews. And we have this I couldn't tell you what the reduction is, but now I think we're down to there's just one commissioner doing it, and it doesn't take quite as long. It's 8:30 to 10:30.
Wow.
That's what happens.
Can we get him to go back to jail for 5 days? I know that's not what you want to hear.
We're not paying for jail.
Currently our jail is at a booking level where they won't take anyone on a district court case unless it's domestic violence or the judge put out a no bail warrant. So the person who doesn't show up to the court has a $20,000 bail, because the sixth time they haven't appeared, they haven't signed a promise to appear.
Thank you. Darren Johnson, here, roadside survey. Okay. Thanks, guys. Many of you heard me talk about the roadside survey, and some of you haven't. So I thought what I would do is show a quick little news clip at the beginning to kind of get us all on the same page about what this is all about. So, Jerry, I'll go on to our second slide here. And
this is Shelley's favorite news clip.
I know. I just run
this. Everyone, dozens of local drivers got tested for drugs and alcohol today, and it was their choice. It's part of a statewide effort to learn how many drivers are impaired and how legal marijuana could impact those numbers. Samina Engel volunteered for the survey as well. It's our big story.
Have you had anything to drink today?
That was among several questions researchers asked drivers in West Valley. They volunteered for this roadside survey on impaired driving. It was anonymous. In fact, I couldn't record them, so I volunteered to see how it works.
About how old were you when you first started drinking?
She asked about my drinking habits, how many drinks I have in a week, a year, and so on. Researchers stood near Nob Hill Boulevard and 72nd Avenue, offering drivers $10 for a breathalyzer and 50 for a blood sample.
We have had a great response. We had 7 bays open. Drivers were happy to participate.
Drivers answered questions and provided samples in the parking lot of the West Valley Church of the Nazarene. This statewide effort tries to count the number of impaired drivers in Washington. The results will also give researchers a benchmark to compare after pot shops open for business this summer with later surveys.
The data that we're going to gather from the survey is going to be invaluable to us as we try to make public policy decisions around impaired driving. Blah, 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 blah.
I took the breathalyzer, was tested for drugs, and got a warning from my tester.
If you're unable to drive home safely, we will provide you with free transportation.
Drivers who are impaired get help going home or to a hotel room to dry out.
Go ahead and make a fist.
I gave my blood and then headed back to my car. No worse for the wear. One of 900 samples the state expects to collect. In Yakima, Samina Engel, Action News.
There will be more surveys throughout the weekend around Yakima and Spokane counties. Surveys in other counties will be done later this month.
So, roadside survey being conducted by the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation. They did their first data collection in June. That was where this news clip came from. And they came back for another data collection in November and early December. So they're collecting data in 6 counties, Spokane, Yakima, Kings, Snohomish, Whatcom, and Kitsap, and within each of those counties at 5 different areas. We're doing the project very differently than it's been done in other states here in Washington in 2 ways, mainly. PIRE has never before done a public involvement process before their data collection. But that is something that we insisted upon to let people know what this is, who they are, why they're here, what they're doing, you know, what it's all about. And hence our media coverage of the June, and there was more media coverage of the November data collection. And also was different in the way that law enforcement are involved. Law enforcement are providing security for the researchers. That is something that's really needed. The researchers are gathering data during the week, on the weekends, during the day, at night, and late at night, and in good neighborhoods and in bad neighborhoods. So particularly bad neighborhoods, late at night, Security is needed there, but also just to not only protect the researchers and the public going through the research effort, but also, I can't remember what I was going to say about that.
It lended some credibility to the fact that it wasn't just some random group of
yes.
people on the parking lot.
Exactly, because, as you know, in our society we have criminal elements that do odd things and could come up with something that looks completely like this and be an identity theft racket or something like that. So to give it that sense of, this is real because they have my Yakima Police Department here, and they wouldn't have invited them in, I suppose, if they were a bunch of criminals. So data collection that just took place in November ended up December 6th. How did this differ from what happened in June? Well, for one thing, it was very cold in eastern Washington. I don't know why sometimes people from the East Coast think that all of Washington kind of looks like Seattle with respect to weather. It's going to be rainy. It's going to not be so very cold. Well, they got an Arctic blast over there in Spokane and Yakima, so they were freezing. And they didn't collect as much data this time around. About 600 drivers went through the survey, whereas 926 went through in June. And why was that? Well, the researchers are asking that question and analyzing what took place. A couple of things were different. Well, the cold. As you saw from the news clip, they basically positioned themselves by a busy intersection, and so the researcher has a big sign that says paid voluntary survey. In Spokane, after conversations with the Spokane Police Department, there was a little bit of a change in that the researcher was not able to walk up to the car perched at that intersection. They had to stand back. A little bit of a change. Did that affect how many people between the cold, Arctic temperatures, not going to roll down my window, don't know who this person is, don't know if that made a difference? There was less media publicity. Well, of course there was less media publicity because it's not the big story it was in June. So did that make the difference in the number of people who were willing to go through the survey? And then one other thing, in Seattle, there was a little bit of a kind of a hiccup in the sense that Seattle Police Department did not provide security for the researchers. It was the King County Sheriff. But they were able to work within the jurisdiction of Seattle in the June data collection. This time around, there were a lot of conversations, delayed decisions, and right before the start of the data collection, they said, you're going to have to go outside the city limits. So that delayed the media notifications and, kind of snowballed a little bit. So less publicity around the Seattle effort and a little bit of change in locations, which Pyre said probably won't make a difference. This time around, we did get asked the question, well, how many people have the impaired driver protocol administered to them? Remember, you come into the survey, you're impaired. They're not going to let you back out in the flow of traffic. You're dangerous. So they have this whole protocol that they've, established in taxis and hotel rooms and tow your car and choices. They had two of those in this last go-round, whereas they had eight in June. So kind of an interesting change there as well. And then no security problems this time. You'll recall in the June data collection, they had some really rough neighborhoods around Seattle that they were working in, and they went to a little less rough this time to cut down on things like gang members brandishing weapons at the guy asking people if they would go through the survey. So no security issues this last time around. And it's always, easy the second time you do something, easier anyway. So that was certainly what they saw. So you have in your packet the preliminary report from the June data collection, and I'd just like to mention a few things about that, and you have it to read thoroughly at your discretion. So again, six counties, five locations within each of those counties, 926 drivers in all went through the survey. And of the drivers who went through the survey, this number of breath tests, saliva samples, blood samples. The blood sample count was very high. In fact, even in Spokane, that was their first place where they went with the survey. They had so many people volunteering to give blood, they ran out of equipment for the phlebotomies. I mean, it was really shocking fire. And, they think that was probably a result of all the advanced media publicity telling people what it was all about. Now, why would anybody do this? Well, it's a $60 stipend for those who go through. So I myself wouldn't go through it probably, but
we can
give
$60 and smoking.
There are a lot of people that like that $60 stipend. And about 20 minutes of time, generally speaking, so yeah, okay, yeah. Not bad. So for purposes of discussing some of what I'm going to be discussing here, I want you to know that in the larger PIER report, the final report, we will have a much more in-depth view of what's taking place here. This is just kind of a quick little snapshot. A particular age group of male drivers are overrepresented in this quick little snapshot, and they are male drivers aged 20 to 34. They are 21% of our population and 45% of our survey sample. So when you see these answers, I just think that's kind of important to keep in mind. Let's see if I can. Okay, so here we go. So the group that were willing to answer this question, and this was from that little knowledge and awareness survey that they did on the little iPad, they were asked, have you ever, even once, used marijuana? And you'll see that 69% of the respondents said yes. So 615 of the 888 people who answered that question said, yes, sometime in my life, I have used marijuana. As you know, when you answer survey questions, sometimes when you answer yes to this, then you go down this road, or if you don't answer yes, you answer no, then you go on to the next question. So they were looking at the people who said they used marijuana in the last year, which is a subset of that first group. These are people who are current users. Have you used marijuana within 2 hours of driving? Are you using pot and driving? And 44% said yes, or 97 out of the 220 who answered that question, have you used marijuana within 2 hours of driving, said yes, they have. And I think that's pretty important for our work because people are getting high and driving. That's important for us to know. So the drivers who said they've used marijuana within 2 hours of driving were also asked, did it affect your driving? Did it degrade your driving? Or when you used marijuana and drove, how did you think it affected your driving? So those first three categories didn't make any difference, made me a better driver. Well, actually, the first two, I would say. So these are people that are saying, basically, it doesn't make any difference or makes me a better driver. A lot of them answering that in the affirmative. So 87% of the respondents said, doesn't make any difference, makes me a better driver. Interesting that down in that bottom one, sorry, Marcia, made my driving worse, only 3 said it made my driving worse.
Donna, put your controller down. It's the wrong one. I'm afraid you're going to turn off your PowerPoint.
Oh, my gosh. I have
just dropped it. We've got
you
covered.
You guys are good.
There it is.
Drop the controller.
No wonder it works better. Yes, thank you. She turned down the whole thing. That sounds like Donna. Let's catch up here. So the survey respondents were asked the question, how likely do you think it is that a person could be arrested for impaired driving after using marijuana within 2 hours of driving? In other words, backing up to the larger group, if you drive high, will you get a DUI? And a large number of the respondents said they think it's likely. So that's encouraging. 89% of the respondents, or 783, said that it's likely, very likely, or at least somewhat likely, that they can get a DUI if they drive while high. And that's it. So we have an educational video about this on our webpage. And Sandy.
I want to ask a quick question about, alcohol and marijuana. Are we looking at sort of the combo and difference in that?
I was wondering about that myself. And what I need to do is circle back with questions and ask PIER, as I look at these answers, are you smoking pot and driving? I'm wondering, how does that compare with the guys that say, I drink a lot? Well, do you drink and drive, too? So that we can get a comparison there. We do know that people that smoke pot also drink. I mean, combine the two from the fatal
oftentimes, if marijuana is involved, alcohol is also involved. And they have a synergistic effect. So 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 2. It's more like 6. So
that's why, I guess, why I have a researcher that has been working with us since Mother. She's asked that question. So have you thought about changing the threshold for alcohol allowance if there's also marijuana presence in the system? Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't even know if we have, I mean, one, we don't have the test yet probably to do that, but two, do we even have the data to know what that would be? So for instance, it's not 0.08 if impairment is any amount of alcohol and marijuana. It creates a different penalty. It's an interesting idea.
It is an interesting idea, especially given that it has a synergistic effect. Not one that I've heard. Have you, Shelley, in any of your impaired driving conversations?
Well, it is interesting that we don't have any. So 0.08 gets you one set of penalties. 0.15 gets you a different set of penalties. But 0.08 in drugs or multiple drugs still keeps at that base level of penalty. So it's just
no enhancement
right. For it.
So the actual data that we'll be hoping from NHTSA or NPIRE will break down, obviously, the number of drivers that provided the breath, oral samples, and then blood. Is at the December Governor's Highway Safety Association board meeting was mentioned by them that we were going to have it within 60 days. So the likelihood of us getting that first data in the next 60 days is, as you know, a hope. So as soon as we get that data, we'll be able to provide that to you so that you can see that. Because, you know, one of the concerns at the very beginning is, well, if somebody's impaired, they wouldn't pull into these anyway. Well, there were numerous people, especially just in some of the preliminary data that we received, was the comment was, you have a significant heroin problem in your state. You also are well above the national average for marijuana for drivers on the roadway. So, because the national average is about 7.2 or 7.3%, we were way above that. So, which is, I mean, when you look at things, and if you were going to make a, you know, a hypothesis, you'd say, yeah, yes, our drivers would have more marijuana in the system. And that has lended out to be, at least during the June survey, to be true. So the November one, we'll be very interested to see what kind of comes out from that in the collection. Now, the PIRE and NHTSA have also indicated that they want to come back in June of 2015 and do a follow-up, because that third one they feel like will help to validate those other samples, because you do a pre-sales, post-sales, and then a year later being able to do a follow-up. And the reason I'm sharing this with you is because in the last continuing resolution, the Congress put some language in that federal fiscal year dollars cannot be used for the National Roadside Survey. As you know, they do these like every 7 to 10 years, so they're not going to be doing a National Roadside Survey in 2015. But the funds that they do have for this project were well before that. It's been already gone through NHTSA legal, and they are still able to continue to do the process for this through 2015. And you'll be hearing more about that as we get closer to June, especially the locations. Very similar to what we've been doing in talking to my peers around the country, especially from Texas, where a lot of the concerns came out of, is, and then with NHTSA, they're like, you guys have now really changed, because we were concerned, if you're not having officers pulling people in, if that would change the methodology of the research, and we were able to get past that. The researchers said, no, that's not going to make a difference. So by the little tweaks that we made here, is now NHTSA is going to be employing those in their next process when they do their next National Roadside Survey. Because I think that they'll be able to get Congress to get back on board again with this. Because it is critical for us to know where we're at nationwide, especially as more states go to a legalized recreational marijuana process. So you'll be seeing some of that and more of that coming forward. So I just want to make sure you were aware of that. So, and Jonna is like our marijuana queen. So, I mean, it is really, I mean, there's so many questions and so many unanswered questions right now. You know, she's digging in and trying to figure out a lot of the issues, especially as it relates to traffic safety. So my hat's off to Jonna taking on some kind of this monumental project.
Karen runs around calling me the marijuana expert, and I run after him and go, don't say that. It is a very complex area and so many moving parts. So,
yeah,
we're just like everybody else trying to keep our heads wrapped around it. But any other questions about fire? And I think
okay.
Just sort of this occurred to me when we were talking about the impact of the revitalization on driving use, that if we see when we get a commercial driver having a positive test, we use their license being disqualified by DOL as our indication that we track the drug test independently of DOL. But it would seem like it, as we go on, we can see what the data is, the change in the number of positive tests with commercial drivers.
That's a good data point to be keeping in mind, how it's affecting the CDD or commercial driver licensing situation, and keeping our fingers on that pulse.
Because there was a point where the actual trucking unions themselves were going to be making a push that if it's recreational marijuana is now legal in Washington, is that can the drivers now smoke marijuana? And they have to be reminded that it is still against federal law, you know, especially as a commercial vehicle. But they said, well, what about those that are working that are operating in intrastate operations and not interstate? So it's now creeping into this arena. It's becoming bigger and bigger.
Third positive test in 5 years results in lifetime disqualification in CDL, so that's pretty much a deterrent to commercial drivers to just party as needed.
Right. Party hardy.
We are seeing more legal challenges
Shelly,
legislative.
All right. So I'll follow in Jana's footsteps and start with the video.
Then you need to start with the wrong flicker.
Stopped is for texting while you're driving.
No, I was trying to put it with navigation to Google Maps.
Okay, so you're entering something into GPS?
That was my intent, yeah.
So this is another one of those situations where, you know, we saw all the indicators that are consistent with texting while driving. You know, he's got the phone directly in front of him. He's looking down at the phone. He's looking up at the road. He's manipulating the screen with his thumb. He's doing it over an extended period of time. And it turns out that all he's really doing is entering GPS information into the phone over, you know, an extended period of time, because he's got to put the city in, he's got to put the address in, he's got to put all of the other information in. And therein lies one of the difficulties with the texting laws, is like, so, you know, everything else that you know on the phone is just as dangerous as texting, but those other behaviors aren't necessarily illegal. Just keep in mind, I mean, you are kind of taking your eyes off the road for, you know, extended periods of time. I don't want you getting a crash.
I understand.
So, drive safe today. My name's Clark.
Thank you.
when they do a film when the light turns green, a lot of times they won't realize the light's black. Right now, he's still sitting there, he's still texting, and he just realized it turned green. The slow turn. He's still texting. You see him cross the white line, or not cross it, but he's weaving a little bit in his traffic, in his lane of travel. This is a perfect example of distracted driving where, you know, if a bicyclist was in that bicycle lane, there's a potential he could have hit him with his mirror. Still weaving, getting close to the bicycle lane. Hello, sir, how are you?
Good, good.
Good, good. You're being audibly and visibly recorded today. I have a microphone on.
Okay.
Just so you know. I saw you texting while you were driving.
Oh, I wasn't texting.
You weren't texting?
I had the phone on like this.
Yes, sir.
Looking at my trades like this.
Looking at your trades?
Yeah.
Looking at
my currency trades.
Currency trades,
yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
I was behind you way back there on Orleans and Sunset, or Orleans and Barclay.
Okay.
And that's where I saw you. You had the phone and you...
I'm not going to say I wasn't using it, but I wasn't texting. I would say...
Yeah, okay, so you were accessing the internet?
Yeah, I was.
Okay, so I saw you accessing the internet. The light turned green for you to make a left-hand turn, and you actually waited about a second and a half before you started going because you were so focused on your phone. Did you realize that?
I did not.
You did not realize? And then as you drove down Barclay, you were still focused on it, and you were kind of weaving a little bit.
Okay.
Did you realize you were doing that?
I did.
Okay. And you realize, I mean, that's a bicycle lane that you were weaving against.
Oh.
Do you understand that that's...
safety.
It is a big safety concern. I know other states have it written where it's as simple as no handheld electronic devices. It's just that easy.
Here in the city of Spokane, the prosecutors and the local judges have ruled that the law is pretty specific, that it says texting. It doesn't say email or Facebook or changing my music, and so they basically said that if they don't admit to texting or don't deny it, if they tell you that, you know, they were on Facebook or they were doing an email, you're not going to get a committed finding here in Spokane. That's the way that our prosecutors and judges have ruled.
It's just great to see how much their eyes are off the road when they're texting. I can really see it here. So that's what we're setting out to kind of correct. We've got a permission from the governor's office to run agency request legislation. Erica in our office made a great infographic on it. I'll pass that around. However, we are without a sponsor. So we had a sponsor who, when he went to his caucus, found out that it wasn't a very popular bill there, and he decided not to sponsor, and we are still... contacting representatives and senators and asking them if they would please be sponsors. So if anybody knows somebody who would like to sponsor this bill, please get in touch with me right away. We're bumping up against the time here already, even though it's only the second week. And then Darren wanted me to keep this to 5 minutes. So I'll just tell you that I went to print out all of the bills that we're tracking right now so that you can have a copy of that, and I couldn't get into the BAT system. So I will give that to Jerry and have her send out the list to you guys. And if, next time, we can have a more thorough discussion on what's happening with budget.
Okay, I'm going to defer some of my time to Etika just to briefly go over kind of the TZM statement of work, kind of where we're at as far as the update and kind of the process.
Okay, I'm going to make this really quick. So I just have a couple of bullet points to read off, and I will start by right before the holidays, Director Grundell sent out an email, kind of an overview to our contract regions. So there's going to be we're going to be heading out to our contract regions. I think there's seven. And kind of reviewing what we've developed as our statement of work process development, like how we're going to, what the roadmap's going to be. Starting, we're going to go ahead and start with the contractor regions because there's this extra layer of work that needs to be done to secure a state procurement. So we are going to be going through the state procurement process, and I'll just talk real briefly at the end about the FTE situation and how we're going to proceed with the customized statements of work there. We asked Dr. Hoff to provide us region-specific data to include fatality, serious injury, and priority areas. So that data has been collected and is done. And so we're going to be using that to help us develop the customized statements of work when we proceed. Just recently, a couple days ago, I sent out an email to the contract regions requesting contact info for partners to participate in a survey and provide feedback to us, the Traffic Safety Commission, on programs they'd like to see the TZM specifically spend their time on. That information will help guide us in the development of the local the customized statements of work. As a staff, we'll sort through the data and feedback and develop a draft statement of work, and then we'll start the negotiations. We'll be working with state procurement to get the specs up ASAP, and that meaning, you know, we all have been through procurement a time or two, so we know that that can be a process. But we're hopeful, and we've done it a couple of times here, so I'm hopeful that it's going to be an easy process. At that point, we will be also running the FTE areas in a similar fashion. I'm sure we're going to be using a survey as a feedback tool so we can develop those localized statements of work. And that survey is going to be designed to provide us feedback on what, like I said, what the local partners decide would be beneficial and important to see as implemented in the local in the customized statement of work. But also coinciding with the localized data, making sure we're not too far off of what the priority areas are showing us that is happening locally. So needless to say, it's going to be a really busy 6 months, but we're looking forward to it. We've got a lot of people here that are going to be working with us together, obviously, director, deputy director, myself, a couple other program managers, and the data and research team. So.
Any questions? Okay, just as kind of as some updates, as you know, Sharon Dillon, I guess, retired from her county commission position, and so as you know, back in the October meeting, we had recognized her and thanked her for her great work, and unfortunately, she left us, and Agency for Boards and Commissions is still working on replacing her position. For the Washington Association of Counties, so we're still waiting for that. So it can be kind of a long and lengthy process, but we're still waiting to fill that position. The movement within the commission of eliminating the project director position and then reallocating for Shelley's position as the legislative liaison, the program management position that was vacated. We are in the process. The applications have already gone out. And I believe it's the 20th through the 22nd. Oh, the 23rd.
8th and 23rd, I think.
We'll be conducting interviews. There were 32 applicants, did 14 phone interviews, and from that was filtered to 10 folks for interviews. Will be done on the 20th and the 23rd. So we will be hoping to have that position sometime in mid-February, 1st of March, so along those lines. So just so that you're aware of that. The grants have all gone out, at least the grant notifications for federal fiscal year 2016. It's hard to believe we just started 15, and now we're already preparing for 16. The due dates back for those grants are January 30th, because it's due July 1. So January 30th, those are due back. That will go through the screening process with the staff and then with the technical advisory committee and then going out to all the commissioners and all that for the review and then finalization. And then in April, we will be doing the approval for those grants that will then be submitted to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration on July 1. So we can begin for that process. Just to keep on your calendars, on October 13th through the 15th of this year is going to be our Washington Traffic Safety Conference. It's going to be held in Seattle. And we've got a group now that's working to develop the topic and some of the areas there. We have some very renowned speakers that are already being lined up. One specifically who was the New York Times
best-selling author of the distracted driving, of a story about cognitive response and distracted driving. His name is Matt Richtel, and it's one of the Amazon's 20 best books of the year, and offers a really great perspective on distracted driving.
He spoke at the last Governor's Highway Safety Association, and he was kind of the highlight of the conference. He is a New York Times journalist. So, anyways, he was very engaging and has done quite a bit of research in the area of distracted driving. So we're looking forward to having that part of that.
Can we have him call legislators?
What's that?
Can we have him call legislators to help us?
Well, we would like to have legislators there at the conference.
We also want him to sponsor the bill. Just to, you know.
Well, yeah. We all understand baby steps sometimes. Yeah. So additionally, in August 27th through the 31st, 2016, I know it's a year and a half away, but we will be sponsoring, or I should say hosting, the Governor's Highway Safety Association's annual conference in Seattle. That'll be at the Sheraton. We, in December, had the board meeting at the Sheraton in Seattle, so the board could see what the venue is going to be, get kind of familiar with the city, because many people hadn't been here before. So they're very excited for Seattle. When we held the Commercial Vehicle Safety Alliance conference here a few years ago, it was the largest attendance that they had, because many people said that they had never been to Seattle and they were bringing their families. So we're doing everything we can to help support jobs, increasing the economy, and things of that nature. But we're very excited that we'll have that, you know, all the governor's representatives from across the country here in Washington for that conference. We will have a need for a lot of support through that. So we're going to have a lot of, you know, the locals that are here, all the Target Zero managers probably be involved in some of that process. So gear up for that. So we're very excited for that that conference. I've got some good news and I've got some bad news in reference to our fatal rate. For 2013, that's closed out and is finalized. We were at 436, which marks the eighth straight year we've had a reduction in fatals. Even, you know, marginally, just it still was a reduction. Preliminarily, because you know that's not going to be final until December 31st, 2015, is the number right now is at 460. Those numbers will probably drop down as we do and receive more of the death certificates and from the coroner's office and that kind of thing to what we've seen where some of those are non-traffic related collisions. But right now we're at 460. It marks about a 5.2% increase in fatals. Obviously, that's the level we were at 2010. We know we're going to spike up and down. We're not sure the impacts of I-502 on, you know, these fatals and those kinds of things, but we're going to be analyzing that to determine that piece. But the bright side of it is I was just in Oregon for their Office of Traffic Safety. They have a partners meeting every year where they come in and help develop their highway safety plan. And because they redo their strategic highway safety plan every 5 years as compared to our every three. So they were in one of their processes for developing their annual plan. And they have experienced a 12% increase in fatals in the state of Oregon in 2014. So I thought, okay, we're not as bad. We're not where we want to be. But, you know, we're not as bad. But it was very interesting because they are literally panicking about their legalization of marijuana and the impacts it's going to have on their state. They are very limited in resources financially, very limited in resources in law enforcement as far as the human capital that they have there. So I will have to say I'm very grateful for what we have here in Washington and the process that we go through, the data-driven analysis that we go through to make decisions. So we are, I think, sitting in a very good position to continue our descent for fatals. So, but we do have quite a bit of work to do.
So, Darren, question, I know it's all preliminary, but do we know where we've lost ground with the increase from last year?
Not specifically yet. But what I will tell you, in May of 2000, or actually May of last year, we were plus 58 fatals. And so, to see, we started gaining ground at the last part of the year, especially through July and August, which you would expect to see the higher fatality months. Our big months last year were January, February, and March. And then we were plus 58 from where we were in 2013 in May. And then as we got down to October, we were at just about plus 30 from at that point. So we started seeing we were gaining some ground. Why? I'm not positive on exactly, you know, all those particulars yet. because we don't have all of the data back in from some of the impaired driving pieces, so we'll be monitoring that. So the one last thing I just want to share with you, and Jonna's not here, but I was going to have her share. State Farm has provided us with mini grants. This was like the third time that they've provided. They were like their $50,000 mini grants that they give to the commission to then work with the local high schools. The clubs and things can get up to $500 for doing a traffic safety project. There was a competition for students to submit a video to that, you know, either addresses impaired driving or distracted driving or some traffic safety element. And the winners of that would then be given a trip with their advisor or parent to go back to Chicago for the Lifesavers Conference, which is March 14th through 17th of this year. And they will actually be presenting at a breakout session on that. So what a great opportunity for these kids to be, one, involved in traffic safety, but two, being able to present. The Lifesaver Conference usually attracts around 2,000 people. So these two youth will be going. Commissioner Schneider, you'll be happy to know. I don't know if you know Hunter Watson from University High School in Spokane is the winner. What's that?
In Spokane Valley.
In Spokane Valley.
That's great.
So she will be going. Her father is the counselor, so she'll be able to go. And then the second one is Kennedy Quinn from Hokomo High School. So I've made phone calls to the principals to let them know. So please don't let the cat out of the bag. But I want to let you know. But we're hoping to make the announcement with conjunctions with the Target Zero managers in their areas, the sheriffs, the police chiefs, and let them know, because this is a big deal for these kids to be able to go to this conference and for State Farm to be taking care of a lot of the expenses. So anyways, those are just some of the updates. Thank you very much for all of the hard work this last year. Hoping to make 2015 much better than we had in 2014. So, you know, we've got to find some ways to reduce those fatals and continue that process that we've had going down. So, anyways, that's what I have for my report. I think we've got everything covered. I'm sorry, Commissioner Kohler.
I have 20 minutes, so I won't get a ticket yet.
Okay.
So, anything from the governor you'd like to pass on?
No, not that I can think of. Of course, you know, it's the first week of session, so. Okay. There's a lot of marijuana bills up here, drones.
Are you talking about the same people, or just?
There is a weird crossover.
Just a couple comments. I just wanted to get into the minutes. In November, we had a very successful Cooper Jones community meeting that NJ and Chris attended. That we got a lot of good things done there, identifying some gaps in policy in the state regarding bicycle pedestrian safety. Look forward to continuing to meet that group. And then this morning, I testified in favor of Senate Bill 5002. Senator Patton, I wish John was here. He asked me straight up, well, do we have any data for marijuana usage in cyclists? And I said, no, that's just one of the main areas that we use for more data for bicycle and pedestrian stats for our state. But I don't think, did anybody testify against the bill? They did. Okay, I left too quick. I thought it was a big kumbaya moment. We're all in it.
The Cannabis Action Coalition, Steve Starch, testified against the bill and said that there was federal law that would prohibit us from not allowing him to carry his medicine in the truck.
Carry is different than buy, though.
Well, the open container would be open container, so you'd have to put it in your trunk. So he could still carry it.
He could still transport it. He just couldn't, you know, put it in his hip pocket. That seems like a pretty small inconvenience. I have to say, though, that I cited the prior information in that, even though I got it wrong. It was 23%, and I think it was actually 24. But that's just an example of how that data is really important. Hopefully, it will help influence that legislation.
Yeah.
Darren, can I add something as well?
Yes.
the governor when I was sharing with him the motorcycle video, the statistics, and kind of what the video was all about, was also interested in the possibility if we could do something for bicyclists.
That'd be something like the Cooper Jones Committee.
I was the first thing I was thinking when I saw that, because you don't often see that perspective enough. I love how it was the motorcycle operator talking about the disadvantage they're at on the road. Great.
Yeah, so, and the governor's an avid bicyclist, so he was very interested in that.
Great.
Yeah, put him on the videos. Avid bicyclist.
Do it.
Yeah, he probably would do it. So just wanted to raise that as a comment that he had.
Okay.
Half a million hits.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, in one place, it's 4.5 million hits.
Oh, I meant 5 million.
Yeah.
Anything else? Everybody, thanks for your hard work, everybody who presented today. That was great information. This was a fantastic meeting. Do you have a motion to adjourn?
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? We are adjourned until 8:16.
All right. Thank you.
Are you going to say 4:16?
What's that?